I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In. My guest today is Ron Hoffman, who in 2003 became the founder of an organization in Falmouth, Massachusetts, called Compassionate Care ALS, that's CCALS, which has helped over 1,000 families with Lou Gehrig's disease on both practical and spiritual levels, above all by being deeply present. His memoir, Sacred Bullet, published in 2014, reveals in powerful and personal terms how his own healing is woven into his work. Ron has worked with individuals, families, and healthcare professionals across the United States, inviting conversations around the choices and possibilities that arise for those living with a terminal illness. He has been relentless in his determination to change the systems that hinder rather than help the dying, with profound implications for how healthcare systems in general desperately need to be humanized. So, Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stuart. Yeah, it's good to be with you. Very much so.
Good. It's good to be with you, too. I feel very honored. I have to admit that when I came across your work was through a newspaper article, and it sounded like really incredible work that you're doing with a very difficult disease. And I really didn't realize in ordering your book, Sacred Bullet, even though it was billed as a memoir, just how personal it was going to be. It was really a challenging read in the sense, not in a conceptual way, but in a visceral feeling kind of way. I feel very honored and blessed to be able to hear what it's been like for you and the families. And I'm just so impressed by your courage in not only in writing the book, but also in what you describe in the book.
You know, I think it was 2010 when I started the book. It was a 4-year process. And of course, I've been in the world of ALS since 1997, when I was a caregiver for a gentleman named Gordon Heald. And upon Gordon's passing in October of 1998, and prior to this, we had discussed creating a fund in Gordon's name. And Betsy, Gordon's wife, supported my work and helping people figure out how to be living with ALS. And of course, I only knew what I knew, which wasn't a lot, quite frankly, back then. And as Gordon and Betsy and I were living with ALS and I becoming his full-time caregiver, you know, as things were going on, it's like, how are people living with this? How do people do this? We were navigating as best as we could. We'd get information from other organizations at the time. There were only two. And we'd look at the material and it just didn't seem relevant to our experience. So that's where a seed was planted for me. And fortunately, when I approached Betsy and Gordon about a month prior to his passing, fortunately, they said, yes, let's create a fund in Gordon's name. And that's how it all started. And of course, I asked him, do you want to support research or help people? Fortunately, I said, let's help people. So it started as the Gordon Heald ALS Fund. And I guess it was in 2003, we created, or I should say the Gordon Heald Fund, birthed Compassionate Care ALS. And in actuality, in all the years I've been doing this as an organization, for all those early years, it was pretty much me. Now we have a staff of 16, plus consultants around the country. We work with folks all over the U.S., probably over 40-some states, primarily Massachusetts, New England, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, and many countries around the world. So in reality, we probably work with close to, if not over, 3,000 families. Been doing this a long, long time. You know, the book was just something I had thought of for a long time, and opportunity presented itself. Things just unfolded. Things just came into place in a very beautiful way. And fortunately, a dear friend of mine, James Church, who has written many books in the past, helped me create this book. But it was a 4-year process in writing this book. It was probably some of the deepest inner work I ever did, not knowing that was what was to unfold here. But it was quite a process in writing it, not just in telling my story, but sharing the stories of what it looks like and must be like to be working or living with ALS, and the ability to show up in the most appropriate ways. I mean, within the confines of the book, I talk about, because it's what I believe with all my heart, for people who are in the caring profession in the medical world as they're tending to their patients. What came to me early on is if they aren't willing to become more familiar, one, with their own mortality, with the reality of their own dying, with their own, to be able to do deep inquiry into that, to do deep inquiry into their own woundedness, because we all have woundedness. If we're unable to do that, then how do we best tend to our families? And I say that we really, really can't do it. So that was had a lot to do with the creation of the book, and in many ways, a legacy, my legacy, which is just my story. And we all have stories. We all have a story.
Just to amplify a point that you made earlier, this book is not a medical book. It's not about the medical aspects of ALS. It's not about diagnosis and not about treatment. It's not about research findings. It's not about statistics. It's about the lived experience of the person with ALS, with their caregivers, or what you call tenders, which we can get to that a little later, and what it's like for you, what it's like for people supporting the supporters. It's all about lived experience in the most profound way. And it's not a religious book per se. I mean, I guess using the distinction between religion and spirituality, it's not about a religion, but it certainly has a very deeply spiritual component. And you clearly are a very spiritual person in your, whatever your belief systems are about afterlife and about connections with people. There's a profundity to the book. And I could imagine, and you mentioned that how hard it was to write the book, that you would have to, if you're going to be deeply honest about what you wrote about, you'd have to pretty much relive everything you talked about in the book. And that must be what was so difficult in doing that.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I was fortunate because early in my career, as I was doing this, it's like, what am I doing? I mean, I had no idea what I was in store for and what would be created. Fortunately, along the way, I met some extraordinary people who became my teachers, my mentors, colleagues, and friends over the years. And it's very, very pan-cultural. You know, I believe in many things. So there's a bit of a Buddhist take in the book. There's, some Native American traditions, my Jewish tradition, many traditions, because I think it's all interconnected. For me, doing this work and what I was able to tap into beyond my own spirituality was just that soulful piece that's missing in our healthcare system, the spiritual aspect, the soulful aspect. People are diagnosed with ALS and all of a sudden, they're traumatized, whether they know it or not. And there isn't a lot of support around that. I guess for myself, I would get the question, why are you doing this work? I mean, even today, my team, we talk about it. What brings us to doing this work? What brings people to the world of healthcare? What motivates people in the world of hospice to be in the world of hospice? Because we're dealing with end of life day in and day out. For me, it was someone touched my life that I had never, ever forgotten. And I think if people are willing to do that deep inquiry into how did we get here? What brought us to this moment? I really think that they would find that there was a circumstance in their life that brought them to this place in order to be of service in the world. I firmly believe that we're born into this world to be of service, that our souls come into this world. And if we're fortunate enough to have extraordinary parents that can nurture us, teach us right from wrong, and then that's all a parent can really do, in my opinion, is teach your children right from wrong. Teach our children right from wrong. Nurture us. Guide us. And unfortunately, that's not the culture we live in as much as I would like to think.
Yeah, I would add to that, too, the parents can, I don't know if I would use the word teaching, but give you the feeling that you're precious. If you have that, then you have everything almost. If you don't have that, you're in for a lot of trouble, trying to find that inner conviction.
Well, when we think about how we raise ourselves as children, and I know it was lacking for me, though I had a mother that loved me completely. And what I learned from a dear friend and colleague of mine, Julie Brown Yao, who specializes in trauma, especially developmental trauma. And the simple fact that, you can see a mother holding her baby in one hand and on her cell phone on the other hand, that's a complete lack of connection. And something as innocent as that can actually have big ramifications down the line because it's about connection. And the work that I do, the work that my team does and what my strong beliefs are is what we've been able to create is very much a relational model, which also means it's about connecting to people. For me, one of the first things I share with families, and whether we're talking about ALS or any other illness, this is all relevant to me. But one of the first things I share with folks is, I'm not here to tell you what you don't want to know, right? And sometimes people look at me, well, why are you here, Ron? And it's like, listen, you know, I meet people who want to know everything sometimes. I meet some people that don't want to know anything. And most people are somewhere in the middle. And it's important that we honor people where they are and help guide them along the way. In many ways, what we do, the work that I do, the work that my team does, we're guides. And advice isn't something that I give, and that sounds awkward to some people. But for me, advice means I'm telling you what I think you should do. So rather than advice, I believe in counsel, which is what I learned along the way and which we all actually know in our bones, because that's how our ancestors showed up in community together. They sat in counsel. They listened to one another. And, you know, that's something that I think is also lacking in healthcare. And yet I'm grateful in our relationships with those in healthcare that, you know, part of what we do is rubbed off. So it's like fundamentally, if I had a wish, is to fundamentally change the way healthcare is given and bring the humanity even more so into it. And it's getting better, but there's still such a long way to go. Such a long way to go.
Yeah, I'm not sure I share your optimism about it getting better. In fact, next week I'm going to be interviewing my cousin, who's a retired nephrologist, about the corporatization of healthcare from the point of view of a doctor who saw that happening to the institution he worked at, which is a teaching hospital in Cleveland. It's really, I think, a dire situation, and certainly your work is kind of an antidote and a pushing back against that. The first section of your book is called Showing Up, the Art of Being with Others. I mean, that's just, you know, a beautiful phrase. If you don't mind, I'm going to just read a little bit from your book about your critique of the American healthcare system. I thought this is very well said. This is actually later in the book, page 189, but I think it sort of fits in this part of the interview. So much of what passes for the norm is just not good enough. There is way, way too much red tape, bureaucracy, and insensitivity. So much that it is downright neglectful. That's why I don't believe in paperwork. It's a statement. Here you are trusted at your word. You need something? You got something. We get it to you. End of story. No forms to fill out. Doctor's reports to be reviewed. Proof of need required. Let there be one place where a family in crisis can rest, let out a sigh, shed a few tears, or rant if necessary, and be loved regardless. Let there be one place where you're not treated like a circus poodle driven through an ever smaller and higher series of hoops. I mean, there's a lot of passion in this book, yeah. even that, a lot of passion. And of course, it's not just a critique. It's a recipe. I don't want to use forget the word recipe. It's a vision of how it can be done differently. And through your lived experience and with beautiful descriptions, many, many, many examples of patients, you probably don't even use the word patient, of people that you've worked with, you know, with ALS and those who are attending to them.
Friends, families, patients is a dicey word.
Yeah, I don't use it in my work. I use the word client.
Yeah, exactly. Patient means there's something wrong with you, okay, to me. I remember going to appointments, doctor's appointments with Gordon in 97 and 98. And it got to the point, well, how many times do we have to answer the same questions? How many forms do we have to fill out? And that kind of stuck with me. So I knew once I created this organization, what I wanted less of is paperwork and bureaucracy, no red tape. And to this day, there's no red tape with us. And that can put some people in healthcare off or in the institution of healthcare, but that's just the way it is. I mean, we have a van program, and so there's a little bit of paperwork there. The best paperwork that I've been able to create as a release form, because we have this, and over the years, we've been able to cultivate a beautiful relationship with the Healy ALS Clinic at Mass General Hospital. Gordon's neurologist, Dr. Merit Shukovitz, who's now head of all neurology at Mass General. So we go back together to 1997. And so along the way, Merit kind of saw what it was I was doing. It was bringing a different way of caring for families. So we've created this great relationship. we now have a house call program that we do with them. So that's an example of where our work already in trying to fundamentally change the way healthcare is delivered. You know, I see it at MGH. They have an incredible team there. And so there's a part of me that's like, wow, okay, we had just a little something to do with that, I think, and how we work closely together and how our ways can, you know, certainly rub off on individuals.
Now, did you have to push back against your own board, you know, to keep things unbureaucratic?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Because I imagine you must have lawyers and, you know, people who have experience with corporations and finance and all that.
One of my fears about a board, and, you know, I certainly have an awesome board, but early in my career when we became a nonprofit and, I need a board, was them to understand the nature of my work, what I'm wanting to do. You know, fortunately, I've got a board that gets me and they support what I do in very big ways. Minimal pushback and sometimes valuing their guidance and wisdom, because maybe there's another way of doing this. But I'm incredibly grateful for my board. I've had several board members over the years that found it difficult to be on the board because they were used to a traditional board. And it was kind of hard for them. And along the way, they decided this wasn't for them, which was fine. For me, it's all about the care. It's about the work. It's about tending to, caring for individuals and families and communities, navigating the complexities of living with ALS in this case. You know, it can be hard. I mean, I do whatever we can do to enhance quality of life for individuals and their families. And you create bureaucracy, it just gets in the way. There's too much pencil pushing and too many papers. And so we do our best to make things happen as quickly as we can, which in turn is the struggle, sometimes never fast enough. You know, people are in all sorts of difficult circumstances. Everyone does not have the capacity to tend to a loved one living with something like ALS. Everyone doesn't have the capacity to be, a caregiver, one who's tending to their loved ones. And so, you know, we're able to help bring whatever we can bring to the table to assist that. And there's nothing in the ALS experience, and that sounds like a bold statement, nothing in the ALS experience that there's not something we can bring to the table. It might be a little bit, or it can be a great deal. In those rare times where there's something new, then we'll help you find out. So again, we walk along side by side with families as best we can. And we've just been doing it a long time. But it's about the people. It's about caring for and tending to those in really, really difficult circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I think of it as one of the most difficult diseases. I mean, there's more than one really difficult disease, but this one is really iconic almost. The idea of losing control of one's body little by little to the extent where it's impossible to do almost anything except blink one's eyes or move one's eyes. It's just amazing. My mother's father did not have ALS, but he had MS. And, you know, he pretty much lost control of his body, his bowels, he had no vision at the end. He did have hearing and he was able to speak at least. He lasted till he was 92, might have lasted longer if he hadn't lost a swallowing reflex. It was an unusual case because it only started in his 60s. But, you know, I saw what that was like, you know, just how humiliating it must have felt.
Indeed. And, you know, it can be devastating to families. You know, I've seen Huntington's disease. I've seen multi-systems atrophy. So many people in the world of ALS, there's nothing worse. And I listen and, you know, I agree. But my response when I do respond is, well, I'm not sure I know that to be true. Because Huntington, I mean, there's other diseases out there, indeed. But what I try and do, is along the way, share with people, this is how you can live with this. I remind people that this, you know, symptom-wise, things can look so incredibly different from one person to the next. What inevitably happens to many is they go online and there's a great deal of drama online. And people get incredibly caught up in that. My counsel to them is stop going online because all this can look incredibly different. You know, I'm able to share stories of this is how it can potentially look. You know, it's all about the choices and possibility, the choices that people make. And any choice we make in life, any choice we make living with ALS or any other illness is, what does it mean if I say yes to this? What does it mean if I say no? Because any choice we make, there's consequences for. So what does it mean if I say yes or no? So when able, I'm able to share when people are wanting to delve into these topics and explore those possibilities and the potentialities. You know, it's easy to follow, you know, our healthcare workers blindly. Early on, I've had the experience, someone had a procedure and didn't go as they expected. And they called me, Ron, why didn't someone tell me this could happen? I know, why didn't they? You know, so I learned from that. For those who are willing to traverse all of those choices, all of the possibilities, we're able to do that in a language that they can hear and understand and take the fright away from it, right? And that's what's important, I think.
I'd like to segue now to talking about the title of the book and you know the middle section of the book, which you talk about. Well, the title is Mending, Doing Our Own Work to Show Up in a Different Way. And you know, this is the bravest part of the book, I think, is this middle section, talking about your own experiences and what brought you to discover, I guess, the depths of your own compassion. It didn't start out that way. I mean, the seeds of it started out that way, but it took quite a lot of work to mine the depths of the richness that one can get from really grappling with and processing one's suffering, because it easily can do the opposite to people. It can make them close down more and more and more. And so maybe we could start just with, you know, explaining the title and how you chose that.
Yeah, well, the title, Sacred Bullet, people living with ALS, I go back to when I was helping care for Gordon. Gordon was looking for the silver bullet. Everyone's looking for the cure, the silver bullet. And as I decided to write this book, when I was trying to think of the name, it took me a while, it took us a while. And everyone's looking for a silver bullet, but what about the sacred bullet? And that's how it came to fruition. Because the circumstances that I lived in my childhood, as difficult and as catastrophic as they were, and it took most of my adult life to realize there's a sacredness to that. But it took me a long time to figure that out and to do that work and to heal as much as I could possibly heal. And so that's where the name came from. Silver bullet, sacred bullet. I don't know. Hopefully there'll be a silver bullet for people where they find something to slow the progression of the disease down and maybe eventually a cure. But, you know, for me, it's the sacredness of the lives that we live. The ALS experience for families, when they're able to, hopefully they can see the sacredness, the sacred nature of their experience that they're living through. That can, in itself can be hard because we're dealing with mortality. I spoke with a woman yesterday, a new family, a new client, and as she was sharing with me, she just let me know that she comes from an incredibly traumatic childhood. I went, whoa. Me too, you know, so there'll be a lot to talk about, but she's someone that has done some work and is willing to explore all of that because trauma is such a very, very big thing. And yet, you know, I am part of my team, the sacredness of what it is that we do, if we can hold it in a sacred way, in a soulful way, when we walk into someone's door and leave our baggage at that door, leave it outside, walk in very clean and clear, then oftentimes, not always, but they recognize something is a little bit different with this person coming in my home. Because we see people in their homes. And there's the opportunity for authenticity to appear when we can walk in, as I say, clean and clear. And when authenticity can show up, one's authentic self, then there's the opportunity for vulnerability to arise. You know, there's a permission, an unspoken permission. And I see this often with families that we work with. The tending to ourselves, you know, it's imperative that we mend our woundedness. And I had extreme woundedness, You know, I mean, I lived a life that from one place to another, as far as this job to that job to this job. And, you know, I grew up in a circumstance where my mother was a battered woman, a battered wife. My father was an abuser. And, you know, it culminated into when my father tried to murder my mother, right? And, you know, they had been separated. I was 10, but they had been separated ever since I had remembered. But there was, oh, my father was always around and just beating the hell out of my mother all the time. And my mother was a very beautiful woman. And my father was a very jealous man who had a drinking problem and probably a drug problem. And, of course, God bless him. I mean, his father was, you know, an abusive father. So, I mean, things are handed down in many ways. So, again, it culminated into my father shooting my mother, and he also shot me as I was trying to intervene. And so that's what I grew up with. And one of the most important pieces I take from this, the sacredness of it, is when I was taken to the hospital. There were two hospitals, and this is 1964. And as I'm taken out of the gurney, out on the gurney, out of the ambulance, I felt a hand on my heart. In these words, "Ronnie, I'm here. You're going to be okay." But the touch, as I'm speaking it, I still feel it. This African-American orderly. And he stayed with me until my cousin Marcia showed up. I never forgot this man. Already, somebody showed up for me. And there's a chapter in the book, Showing Up. And, you know, to this day, I remember this man. You know, I tried to find him many, many, many years ago. And was unable to do so. But in many ways, this is a man who, in my later years, you know, changed my life, you know, along with the opportunity that I had with Gordon and Betsy, a man that I've never, ever forgotten. That's what drives my work, the importance of someone showing up for someone in a really difficult circumstance. And in this case, ALS. And that's been my driving force.
One thing that you don't make too big a deal of in the book is that the bullet lodged next to your spine, and you must have come within millimeters of being a paraplegic.
Yes.
And I don't think you even used that word in the book, if I remember right.
No, you're right. You're right. I remember being in the ambulance, and I couldn't move my legs. And one of the funny stories, as I remember it, is as I'm in the ambulance, they asked me, "Ronnie, do you know what kind of gun it was?" And I look, I said, "Are you serious?" Yes. No, I don't. And I was kind of in and out of consciousness, sort of, you know. And, you know, in the house itself, my mother had came out of the living room and ran into my bedroom, my brother and I's bedroom, and was on my bed as a single bed. And as my father's coming around the curve, I'm kind of running down the hallway to her as I'm hearing, "Your daddy's got a gun. Daddy's got a gun." And as I got to the doorway, I'm kind of like dive into my mother. Literally, I felt like I was flying. It was frame by frame, slow motion. And then I hear a gun shot. And all of a sudden, I knew that I was shot. As I'm diving in towards my mother, I mean, it's all instantaneous, but "I love you too, Daddy. I love you too." Kind of like, is this my fault, you know? And somehow I ended up into the living room. But but my father, after he saw that, he really went off and put like two bullets in my mother with his knee and her groin. So yeah, that was a lot to get over. And there's all these little antidotes and stories along the way that came up.
And your mother survived as well.
How, I do not know. But yes, she did.
And neither one of you were permanently disabled by it, it sounds like.
No. Actually, there was one bullet that they could never remove from my mother because it was too close to an artery or something like that. And then for myself, the woundedness has created a bad back my whole life. Okay? Seriously. Chronic. And yet, you know, I played sports and then there was a football injury, but I've always felt that, quite frankly, I can honestly say probably every day of my life as I stretch my back, I feel it. You know, just a little nerve thing, just a little something there. But it's just something that's common and I'm very used to it.
And in your term, sacred bullet, and the way you talk about your father, you kind of give him credit for allowing you to become what you became, was by providing the pretext and context of your suffering. I mean, it's kind of weird in a way to give him credit for that, but it's sort of credit not necessarily to him per se, but to life, that all of life, no matter how difficult, is what makes us who we are, each of us. And that it's to make the most of life, you have to be willing to grapple.
Well, I want to say for many years I hated my father, but the word hate is a hard word for me. And I remember the first time my brother and I had to visit my father, and I was maybe 12 or 13. He only spent maybe not even 2 years in prison, maybe a year and a half. He had really good connections. But having to testify at his trial and see him as a 10-year-old, and then have to go visit him. The courts made my mother send my brother and I to visit him. And remembering getting out of the shower and changing my clothes, and my father saying, "What's that?" I said, "What's what?" He says, "What's that hole in your back?" I went, "You've got to be kidding me." I mean, talk about almost traumatizing me. I just said, "You know what that is?" I kind of avoided it. He apparently had no memory, okay, of what happened. So it's not that we saw him that often as we were growing up, but it was difficult. And later in life, as I was going through some crazy times, incredible hate. There was a time in New York City in the early 80s where I called him up. I mean, and you know, I was in the hairdressing business and I was very much doing too many drugs. But I called him up and I just remember screaming at him like I had, I mean, it was like, whoa. You know, after that, you know, I remember when my father died about 1999, I think, and 99 or 2000, I don't remember. But I ended up spending a month with him, helping him transition. And that was a crazy experience. You know, I made the mistake of staying with him.
In the book, I mean, it sounds like you really were hoping for some kind of mending of the relationship, as crazy as it was, and it didn't really happen. I mean, you wanted it. You tried.
Yeah, I did.
And I think you said that if you had some of the tools that you have now, maybe it would have gone better. But clearly, he had learned nothing, you know, in all those years.
No, he did learn nothing in all those years. And it was amazing as my brother and I were cleaning out the closets, wrapping up his things and doing what we do in those circumstances. We find a gun, right? And it was like, "You've got a pistol. You've got to be kidding me. The man learned nothing."
And this is after telling you that he didn't have any guns in the house too.
Exactly. Yes, he did. Yeah. He was telling me a story. He had a girlfriend and she called the police because he had a gun, and the police come to see him and he knew them. He said, "I don't have a gun. I would never do that again." Sure enough, he had a gun. You know, in later years, and maybe even in the context of writing the book, where I was able to let go of some things. And quite frankly, it was, you know, I was able to do some more real work around forgiveness, if you will, or letting go. I mean, my father got to be the way he is, quite frankly. I mean, his father was the spitting image. We all have a story. We all are mentored by our parents in some way and taught by our parents. So there's a part of me that truly understands that for him, because there was a part of my father that was actually a sweet guy, right? A lot of people liked him. I guess it was up maybe 4 or 5 years ago when all of this happened. The incident happened, I believe it was March 13th. And I had no idea over many, many years, March would come around and I would be in an awful place, just emotionally. And I could never put my finger on it. My mother's birthday was in March. Finally, one day I realized, oh, it's the shooting. That's when all this happened. And even after I realized it, every year I'd forget it. And then I'd remember that, that's what's going on. But I guess it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. March came around and I felt great. And I realized I'm feeling really good. And I'm saying, something kind of like dripped away. You know, I don't have to hold all of that anymore.
That was the proof of your healing, is that you didn't have to relive it every year.
Absolutely.
No, I'm just curious, you know, the healing work that you did, and it sounded like it took years, quite a number of years of work. Some of that occurred after the foundation started?
Oh, yeah. Most of it.
So that's really interesting, because, you know, to start a foundation like that without having healed first and dragging all that baggage around, which must have weighed a ton, is amazing.
Huge ton. Because again, growing up, there was never any support. I never talked to anyone. As a kid, I remember, well, he'll get over it. They'll get over it. Well, neither my brother or I ever really, truly got over it. So whatever work that I did, whatever counseling I did prior to meeting Gordon was minimal, incredibly minimal. And as I was working with Gordon, as we created the fund, part of my questions that I was delving into was, how the hell am I going to do this? Where do I go to school for this? Who's going to take me seriously? Because there was some pushback from some people in healthcare, right? Because I don't have a degree. You know, I just kind of like put it out there. I need someone to learn from. Anyway, I ended up meeting a man named Jeffrey Duvall at a place called Mentone, Alabama. It was a men's gathering with Robert Bly, the poet, and John Lee, the author of a book called Flying Boy. And actually, John's work, Flying Boy, I was introduced to in the 90s, which is about relationships, men in bad relationships with their women. So that was some work that I did, but I pretended to know more than I knew. And I had a girlfriend at the time that introduced me to John Lee. And so, you know, I met with him. And anyway, I meet Jeffrey Duvall, who became a guidepost for me. And through Jeffrey, he suggested, Ron, you might consider meeting Stephen and Meredith, Stephen Foster and Meredith Little of the School of Lost Borders. So I checked them out. I met them, went and worked with them out in the desert, which is an incredibly profound vision fast that I did. After that, went back to Jeffrey, spent some time with him. Through those experiences, I met a woman named Joan Halifax, Roshi Joan Halifax of Upaya Zen Center. So I've been able to study many different ways, whether it's Buddhism or rite of passage work, the ancestral piece. And Tom Daly, who's an extraordinary psychiatrist, has a program called Four Gateways that he created. My good friend, Julie Brown Yao, who's a trauma specialist. And honestly, through many of my families that I've met, I mean, in some ways, it has been healing for me. So the work is out there if we're willing to do it. I think one of my fears and what I had to overcome was the depth that you had to go. Sometimes it's about cracking yourself open, cracking open your heart. Already, which can be really, really scary, especially for men, feelings and emotions. Well, men, we don't feel, right? And I mean, that's what we're taught. Boys don't cry. So I've been blessed in that way, and I'm eternally grateful. And the work that I'm doing now, it's about bringing the core values of what I learned from all these extraordinary people, all these extraordinary teachers, mentors, guides, friends, to, you know, my community. Right. I remember Stephen saying, as we're sitting in the desert, whatever you learn out here, the importance of taking it back to your community, taking it back to your people, which doesn't mean you give it all away. You know, it's just giving nuggets of it away.
Thank you so much for sharing some of your personal story. But I do want to leave enough time to also talk about what you call tending, and also your thoughts about how American culture deals with disease and death and how we can do it better. If you don't mind, I'm just going to read one more quote of yours. This one's from page 144. There is a cultural wound in America. We shield ourselves from disease and death, living in mass denial about the nature of our condition. It creates incredible loneliness in those who are ill. Why is it we are so often abandoned when things are really difficult? Nobody comes around. Why? Why is that? Do we not realize our time will come and we may want some company? This is one of the reasons I am writing. If I could change something in our culture, it is this very thing. Stop avoiding the truth of suffering and death. Embrace it in others. Show compassion to them. It may come back to you when your time rolls around.
I got a phone call, actually a text last night from a very dear friend who I've not seen in a while, but someone very important to me. And letting me know in the text that she had been diagnosed with, I believe, thyroid cancer, and then she had 6 months to live. This is non-ALS. And I was like, wow. And I just found myself in a place where it was comfortable. I could wail away. And I remember years and years ago thinking of this friend and other friends, thinking about what it will be like when they're no longer here. And what I thought of yesterday as well, as I think of often, is the impermanence of it all. Impermanence. You know, we're here for however long we're here for. And I believe that when we're born into this world, we have a certain amount of time. You know, that's just my belief. And the importance of doing good work in the world while we can. And the ability to show up for individuals, intend in a way that we all deserve. And good tending is being able to really listen. Again, that's why I don't give advice. That's why I give counsel rather than advice. I'm not here to tell you what you don't want to know. Because I think our dying, and many have heard this before, is one of the two most sacred times in our life, when we are born and when we die. And I think if we could come together as a culture and have an understanding that there's nothing more sacred than literally birthing our loved ones home when it's time for them to go home, when it's time for them to cross over, the richness of that experience to be able to do that. You know, as our mothers birthed us into this world, we have the opportunity to birth our friends, our loved ones, if we are in that circle for that individual who's dying. That respect, I believe with all my heart, no one should ever pass away in physical distress or suffering. Do they? Yes. Why? Respectfully, because people aren't paying attention. Whether it's family members who've never had the experience before, or those in healthcare who keep going by their book. I've seen people who have passed away in extreme circumstances. I've seen people pass away in physical distress, not being able to understand why. Again, because maybe people aren't paying attention. Oftentimes, or I should say sometimes, medication is needed. You know, whether it's morphine or you know, any other drug in order to alleviate any physical distress or suffering. I've also seen people who've passed away in very beautiful ways, who've just gently crossed over to go home. It's been my experience, those who are willing to do that inquiry, those who are willing to become familiar with the reality of their own mortality, of their dying, when it has come time, they have gently passed away. Always know, but I've seen it time and time again. And who've come to the place of acceptance and oftentimes, Ron, I'm ready to go.
I had the good fortune to be present at my mother-in-law's death at the age of 90 several years ago, surrounded by both of her children, all of her grandchildren, and a beloved niece. And it was at home, very, very peaceful. So a few days before, she thought she was dying and called a number of people to say goodbye, but then she wasn't ready to die yet. It was going to be a few more days. And she says, after all that, I'm not going to die. I'm going to have to kill myself. She had a sense of humor.
Sure. If we can truly show up for our friends, our family, our loved ones at the time of their death, if we are invited in, which is a very, very important piece. You know, I share with my team all the time, and I write in my book, if I have a need to be there at someone's bedside, I will not go. That need, there's a neediness there for some, having to be there. And that's an intuitive thing, the importance of feeling into our body. We can answer all of our questions by feeling into our body. And so when we do have that opportunity, and if we can take that opportunity, and if we can be incredibly present, and if we can be there and hold that space for what's going on by just being present, not trying to fix the circumstance, just truly be there with love and compassionately showing up, then there's such an opportunity for the mystery to unfold. And there's some places in my book that I won't really speak to, but are there, that were as real could possibly be. And hence, that's the sacredness of departing this world and going home to wherever that place is. I will share this. I had a dear friend who wasn't doing real well. And his wife called me. I went to go see him, elderly gentleman, Elliot. And Elliot was, as I sat down with him, all right, what's up? He said, I'm afraid. I said, afraid of? He said, one, afraid of dying. I said, what else, Elliot? He said, afraid of not being remembered. I said, wow, okay. I said, well, Elliot, you know I'm going to remember you. And I said, Elliot, I need to remind you of the extraordinary work you've done in your life and all the people whose lives that you've touched, on and on and on. And I said, you know, Elliot, I heard yesterday, I either read this or heard it, and I don't know who to attribute it to. He said, what's that? I said, you are never truly forgotten until the very last person who knows of you is gone. And with that, he had this incredible smile on his face, because that could go on forever and ever. That's why stories are so important. Stories of people who we've known and stories that we can share.
Yeah, I would imagine that most of us imagine that we're listening at our own funeral, you know, wishing we could be there alive as we're in the casket. You know, say, well, wait, what, you know, cocking your ear. What are they saying now? Wait a second. Say it a little louder.
And that's why some people will have their own little funeral before they die, invite friends over. For me, what color balloons do you want? I mean, you know, there's some people who are able to take care of their personal business, all of their arrangements, wanting to really talk and engage and create their own party, if you will. That's certainly not for everybody, but those who are able to do that, it's kind of like having a living wake. I've known several people over the years who've been able to do that, and it's been incredibly powerful. That way they can show up at their own funeral, really.
So speaking of one's own funeral, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that the very end of the book, you're imagining your own death. And that was amazing. I mean, was it intended that way? I mean, I think so.
Yes, it was. And it's ironic you speak to that, because I had a gentleman who recently read my book, and gentleman with ALS, and he just wrote back. I forget exactly what he said, but part of it was, Ron, I've got so much to learn. But that part of, yeah, I just visualized my own dying, you know, being in my own bed and who was there, and just imagining myself within my own mind, non-verbally speaking and thanking people and, you know, doing a life review. So, yeah, that was really powerful. I mean, that was, as you speak to it, as I'm remembering, because I wrote this book, it took 4 years. So I'm going back to 2010 or 11. And that was one of the more powerful experiences I had. And I thought it was important to relate that.
Well, I probably speak for a lot of people that when a person reaches their 60s, and both of us are in our 60s, death starts to look a lot closer than it did earlier, even if you're healthy.
Well, time is moving for sure. The older we get, the weeks go by quicker, the months go by quicker, and the years go by quicker. There's no doubt about that. I'm now 67. So in 20 years, that makes me 87. I mean, I get, how much longer can you do this, Ron? I said, I'll keep doing what I'm doing till I can no longer do it. I won't be doing anything else. But it's important to also, for those of us who are in this work, who are the tenders of the world, the carers of the world, to really pay attention to oneself, and to also live our lives, to find joy amidst joy and happiness, amidst the chaos and the suffering that we sometimes see, along with the extraordinary beauty that we sometimes see. So it's really, really all of it. One other thing I'll share with my conversation with my friend. For me, as I was sharing this with him, you know, I asked the question, where do you think you go when you die? And he said, I don't know. I said, okay. I said, is there anything to be afraid of not knowing where it is that you're going? He said, no. And I said, well, is it possible that when we do pass, we're just going home? We're just going home to where we were before we were born. Where are we before we're born? I don't know. So I really think I'm just going to go back to where I was before I was born. And there's nothing for me to be afraid of.
It's hard to grasp either one, I think. You know, where were we before? Where will we be after? It's just such an unknown.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. It's still a mystery. And that's what kind of works for me. And I think oftentimes in my experience, many people are so incredibly afraid. So how can we, as best we can, in a compassionate, caring, loving way, take away some of that fear to let them know that we are there, okay? Whether in person or on the phone or the ability to truly show up.
If you do that, you don't have to know what to say. That's not as important. What exactly you say is not as important as being there and really being there with an open heart. One of the concepts you talk about in your book, which I really loved, was stealth. The people doing the tending, nurses or family members, that if they can tell that the person just needs something, they can just do it. Just sort of flit in and out and not intrude and not call attention to it. And
true.
So it doesn't even have to be words often.
Thank you. So oftentimes silence, being in the quiet, is incredibly profound. Stealth care is the best form of
tending. Care. That's cute.
Stealth care, best form of tending and caregiving. There's no question about it. You know, the ability to hold that space, to be in a room with someone, to be on an outer circle of a room as folks, or maybe whether someone's living with ALS or they're actively dying, but to have the experience of being in that space, being on the outside circle, if you will, and to just hold that space. Oftentimes, there's nothing more important. That in itself can potentially bring incredible calm, because energetically, there's a whole lot going on. And if I'm in a calm place, if I'm holding that space, opposed to me walking in, being there very excited, there's a huge difference in that. And to be able to do that in a quiet, stealth-like way is incredibly important. To be sitting at the bedside, oftentimes maybe doing nothing, maybe just a hands-on, or just sitting and breathing with someone. So there's many ways of being with that. But I mean, ultimately what I hope for, and it's always not the case, is that everyone has the ability, when it is their time, that they can have a peaceful, comfortable, compassionate, loving crossing.
So one of the paradoxes of your book is that you're trying to teach something that can't be learned from a book. You know, it can be a catalyst for going out and living in a different way. And that's what you learn from.
Exactly. It can be learned from experience.
Exactly.
From being in the fire. And it's like, how do you have end-of-life conversations with people? I remember the first time I was at a Being with Dying program many, many years ago, and we did these kind of like mock plays, if you will, mock discussions. And you're sitting with a group of people and their loved one is dying. So what are you going to say? Boy, was I uncomfortable with that. I did not like that at all. I was terrible at it. But that was one of my concerns when I got into this work. But when I found that as I was doing my own inner work, and as the more experience I had and the more that I learned from my teachers and my mentors and my colleagues, it's like, whoa, it became just a natural way of being. I think one of the most important things that we all need to learn is how to get out of the way, how to get out of the way. Because sometimes people can come in wanting to do too much, you know, wanting to fix the circumstance.
I think I have time for you to read just one more little excerpt from your book that I think is apropos here. You say, open your mind and heart to the mystery. Human beings await your presence. Bring to them your presence. Let go of your knowledge and make room for wisdom. Something wants to unfold before you. Hold space for the unknown to emerge. Let love be your guide. Trust.
Yeah. That's nice.
It is. It's really like a poem, and it's really opens up a feeling of reverence.
Reverence. That's a word that came up the other day for some of us, the word reverence. And that's the nature of the work, to be able to be in a place of reverence for individuals going through difficult circumstances, and to be okay to be friends with the mystery that can potentially unfold, to be okay in the unknown. You know, it's in many ways, it's honoring the individuals that we're showing up for in a very honorable way. And a lot of people in the world of healthcare can, you know, I truly honor the work that they do because there's some extraordinary people out there doing extraordinary work. And for that, I'm eternally grateful.
Well, and I am grateful that you're one of them. So Ron Hoffman, it's been such a pleasure to have you on Delving In. Ron Hoffman, the founder of Compassionate Care ALS and the author of Sacred Bullet, a very profound and profoundly moving memoir. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And I invite people to check out our websites, see all the work that we do. We built a beautiful retreat center that's a very special place. There's lots that we bring to the world, and I invite you to check us out.
And that's ccals.org, right?
Correct. Correct. Yeah. And thank you, Stuart, so much for reaching out. And I'm really grateful our paths have crossed.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.